Welcome to the X-Cast, X-Files Podwatch, episode 19, covering Aubrey and Irresistible. I'm your host, Zach Moore, and with me is author of Opening the X-Files, a critical history of the original series, Mr. Darren Mooney. What's up, Darren?
Hey, it's been a while.
It has been. It feels like it's been at least a season since we've talked. So
10 whole episodes. 10 whole days.
So we're talking about two episodes, Aubrey and Irresistible. Today we'll start off with Aubrey. It was written by Sarah B. Charno, directed by Rob Bowman, and it first aired on January 6th, 1995. There's a lot to unpack with this episode, Darren, but first off, what are your thoughts on it? Are you a fan of Aubrey?
You know the way that everybody has, like, everybody obviously has their favorite X-Files, and most of those lists of favorite X-Files are going to be the same. They're going to involve, like, Jose Jones from Outer Space, they're going to involve Pusher, all that sort of stuff. And then everybody has, like, their sort of their curate. They have their sort of their favorite weird choices. Their episodes that are not necessarily, like, love and hate, like, say, Musings of a Cigarette Smoking Man or Never Again, but episodes that are, like, everyone's kind of like, that was okay, and everyone's like, no, this was brilliant. I'm kind of like that for Aubrey, where everyone's all like, well, it's okay, but Oublette is much better in the third season. I'm like, no, Aubrey's amazing. And Aubrey is amazing. It really, really is. So I'm going to lay my cards on the table just now.
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. Soft Light is like that for me. That's one of my favorite episodes, and a lot of people are like, yeah, it's all right. Yeah, okay.
Perfectly adequate.
With Aubrey, you know, genetic memory is a pseudoscience that they haven't really covered yet on the X-Files. And, you know, if nothing else, it explains Mulder's sunflower seed habit, right?
Yeah, I mean, let's be completely honest here. Like, there are some X-Files ideas that are more plausible than others, and there are some X-Files ideas that are completely out there, make absolutely no sense, and if you can't go with the basic premise, it will be completely ridiculous. And the basic premise of Aubrey is, well, what if your dad was a serial killer, and somehow when he impregnated your mother, he passed along not only his predilection to serial kill, but also the very precise and exact memories right down to the faces of people he killed, so that when you get pregnant, you will suddenly have those memories flashing back before you as well. It's a premise that takes a lot to get on board with, and I can understand why people are like, eh, it's okay. But, like, it really is. It's an episode that works very well in, like, dream logic. As long as you're willing to go with it, as long as you're willing to accept that, like, the plot doesn't really make a lot of sense, the science is... pseudo is a very generous description of how the science works in this episode. But even the plot logic and mechanics of it, like, where it's like, well... Oh my god, how did she figure out that the chest had the word brother written on it after she's been investigating a case where the chest had the word sister written on it?
Oh, that was facepalm inducing. I'm like, it says brother, it's a man, it's brother. Obviously, all the women say sister, the man says brother, and then they have to use the state-of-the-art scanning technology to figure it out.
Zach, only a psychic with inside knowledge of the case could possibly have worked that out, thank you very much. But yeah, I think once you go with that, if you're willing to go with the absurdity of the plot, and I completely am, like, I love this episode top to bottom, and I think a large part of the reason why I do is it's Rob Bowman's direction. Like, Rob Bowman is a fantastic director, and in the first season he did it with, say, Genderbender, which is an episode which is a little dated, famous for the sequence in which Mulder and Scully deduce that the killer must change sex because bisexuals do not exist. But I think that Aubrey is just, it's a beautiful piece of television. It's got, like, the wonderful red of the motel light with the car, like, turning on beside the flashlights. It's got, like, the swimming pool scene where everything's sort of lit with floodlights as the characters walk through it. It's got that wonderful Mark Snow score. As far as production goes, it's just a fantastic episode.
Well, guest stars as well, because we have a pre-Lost Terry O'Quinn here. Pre-many other appearances in the Carterverse, Terry O'Quinn. But to me, you know, he'll always be the bad admiral from Star Trek The Next Generation, the seventh season
Pegasus.
Episode of Pegasus. Yes.
Admiral Pressman.
Exactly. So he'll always be him to me. And he's not the only Star Trek guest star here. We have Morgan Woodward, right, who is a very famous face from Star Trek The Original Series. Yeah, he was in Dagger of the Mind and The Omega Glory, two different characters. And the guy... didn't age much in 30 years,
It's remarkable. It's amazing what cigarette smoking and oxygen tanks can do for you. No, he really looks very similar. I suspect he's one of those people who always look kind of old. And so
he's
then
got Steve Martin disease, yeah.
Yeah, so when he got old, it was kind of like, yeah, he now looks about the same age as he should be. and I mean, it's actually funny because these are characters who also pop up, these actors also pop up in Millennium. Obviously, Terry O'Quinn pops up you know, as a recurring character across it as Peter. But I mean, Morgan Woodward pops up at one point as another creepy old man rambling about angry things, because he has that sort of manner about him where he's sort of gruff and old, and he looks like even though he should probably be dead, and I feel really terrible saying this about a person who's very old, but he looks like at some stage death came and he just punched death in the face. But he has this sort of manner about him that's very gruff and very sort of, he has a lot of screen presence, even in this tiny role here.
Yeah, it's a very small role, but it's very memorable as well. And then his granddaughter, spoilers. The thing with her is like, they went way too far with it. Like, she even has to have, like, the acid splashed in her face, right? So she really
she looks
starts
like
to,
the ammonia,
to look.
Yeah,
yeah, it's like, are people not going to get it? Like, it's like, we get it. Yeah. We understand.
How the concept is working here.
The explanation for everything was pretty far-fetched, even for the X-Files standards.
It really is. And I mean, it is also like the bit where he's talking about how his father, you know, you eat sunflower seeds, so he eats sunflower seeds. And Scully's kind of like, well, maybe you learned that behavior. And he's like, no, because that would completely undermine the principle of this episode. And you never really get a plausible explanation for that. But I like, again, we talked about this when we were talking about, like, Young at Heart, about how even, like, people tend to divide the X-Files into the mythology and the standalone episodes. But, like, in the early standalone episodes, there's a lot of, well, this is what the show is about stuff. I think that even in Aubrey, there's a sense of, like, one of the big conflicts going into at the end of the second season with Colony Endgame and obviously with Anasazi is going to be, like, Mulder reconciling with the sins committed by his father and the idea that whether those reflect on him. And then that becomes, like, a big bone running through the mythology. Like, I think with Aubrey, you get a little taste of that, where, like, BJ is sort of condemned by the sins that her father committed, even though she was completely unaware of them. She's somehow bound up and tied up in them. And you get this sense again of, like, when we talked about EBE, we were talking about how, like, the folks in the first season of the Cold War, and then in the second season going forward, it sort of shifts into talking about, like, the Second World War. Like, there's a sense that, like, the idyllic past that BJ's sort of mother recalls is the one in which the 1939 World's Fair, which was, like, an expression of utopian idealism in America and New York, the idea that, like, the future would be brighter and better, but which had to be sort of cancelled and torn down, and how, like, flags had to be replaced when Hitler marched through Poland and Czechoslovakia and stuff like that. And then there's the sense of, like, thwarted utopia. Like, Harry Coakley was arrested in 1945, the end of the Second World War, but his crimes still linger. The effects are still felt. And, like, through the X-Files, there's this recurring sense of, like, memory and identity and how those two call together. Like, the idea that we need to remember the sins that our parents committed and the sins that were committed by earlier generations in order to avoid repeating them or getting trapped in cycles of abuse. Like, literal unearthing of the past, as BJ does when she goes into the field and digs up the corpse of the two FBI agents. Well, the first FBI agent, and then she goes in the basement and finds the second one. Like, I think that Aubrey is an episode that's very close to, like, themes that the Carter is very interested in talking about, and themes that the show is going to basically put a Chinese wall around the start of the third season and say, well, look, this is now the mythology's concern. And one of the things I like about Aubrey is it's like, well, what if we built a monster, a standard Monster of the Week episode that dealt with many of the themes that are going to be core to mythology, like dealing with crimes committed by your parents, or the legacy of the Second World War, or the idea that the truth never remains buried. Like, I really, really like that about the episode.
Man, you're a true scholar, Darren. You should write a book on the X-Files, I swear, man.
One of these days, Zach, one of these days.
All right, our next episode today is Irresistible, written by Chris Carter, directed by David Nutter, and first aired on January 13th, 1995. Now, this is one of those episodes that I wish the X-Files did more of. It's ambiguous, right? Is it supernatural at all? Is it not? I think that's I think a lot of people gravitate towards that point of conversation when it comes to this episode. I think it's most powerful if there's no supernatural elements, right? But it is left open to your interpretation, because, I mean, kind of the point of this one was, you know, the most mundane can be the most evil after all. And, you know, Scully even says it's a lot easier for people to believe in, you know, UFOs and monsters than, like, a human being could commit such atrocities. So I'll just ask you off the top here, Darren, and not thinking about Donnie Faster's return appearance, right? But in this episode in particular, did you feel like there was a supernatural element or not?
Well, Zach, I was about to say, thank goodness there was never a sequel episode to this, because it just stands so perfectly alone. Yeah, no, I agree with you pretty much entirely with what you said there, which is, and what Scully said there, which is this idea that, like, we like to externalize this idea of human evil. We like to pretend that evil is something monstrous and something, ironically enough, alien in the context of the X-Files, that it's something that exists beyond us and something that exists, like, once something is so evil, it can be classified as not being human, as being inhuman almost. And I think that Irresistible works best for me if you believe that Donnie Faster is just a normal guy. And like, that's the point, I think, of the bit where he changes faces while he's sort of tying Scully down. It's, the point is not, oh my god, he's an evil shapeshifter who's actually a demon. The point is, well, no, A, Scully would rather think of him as a demon, as some sort of external source of evil. Even Scully, who is obviously, she's Catholic, but she's skeptical. But also that he could just as easily look like any number of these normal seeming guys. And I think that that's, you're right when you say that's what's most powerful about it. And I think, like, you were talking about how you wish the X-Files had done more episodes of this. Well, you know, it's, luckily enough, there's like a 3-season spin-off that is pretty much, what if we did this for 24 episodes a season? But I think that, yeah, I think Irresistible is just a fantastic piece of television. And it's remarkable because it's an episode, like, the X-Files had never done anything like this to this point. And, like, one of the things I really like about the second season is you get a whole host of these episodes which are like, well, we've never done a comedy. We should try doing a comedy. Or, you know, stuff like, well, we've never done an episode that's basically Contagion. We should do an episode that's like Contagion. And I think that I really, or One Breath, which is, you know, we never did an episode that's set primarily in a hospital while Mulder sits around waiting. We should do something like that. And I think that Irresistible is like, it really pushes, like, what you can get away with on The X-Files. Because we were talking about, like, when we talked about, I think, Young at Heart, we were saying that felt like standard conventional procedural television. Irresistible is like, well, actually, what if we take The X-Files and use that to tell just a story about evil? Just a story about monsters that are not actually monsters, and about how we'd like to believe they're monsters.
Yeah, I mean, I would, not to stick on this point for too long, but you could chalk up Scully's seeing him shapeshift to her PTSD. But it's in the teaser as well, you know, in the morgue there. And I don't know, I feel like maybe, I don't know if that was like a network note or anything. I haven't done the behind the scenes research on this particular episode, but I feel like maybe that stuff was thrown in because they weren't confident enough. The viewers would go for an episode without anything paranormal at all. Cause you know, as we said, this is the first time they've tried that. So there are lots of ways to look at it, and it doesn't, I mean, it doesn't hurt the episode at all. If anything, it just adds more layers of conversation to it. You know, talk about Donnie, man, what a creep, right? I mean, just the epitome of a creep with his death fetishism.
An escalating death fetishist, thank you very much. It's funny you should talk about, like, the network notes and stuff like that. Apparently, one of the big network notes that they got on the episode was, Donnie is not a necrophiliac. Which is why the episode goes out of its way to describe him as an escalating death fetishist. And why Mulder at one point says that, you know, it could be worse. You could have found him in the grave with his blow dryer and his didgeridoo. And then, of course, I think John Chabon, the writer who joins later on, has talked about how after all this, after Fox went to all this effort to sort of downplay his sort of his necrophilia, the immediate TV guide summary was Mulder and Scully chase a necrophiliac.
But best laid plans.
Best laid plans of mice and men. But Chinland is amazingly creepy, and I'm amazed he hasn't got more. Like, he was in Con Air, obviously, where he played a suitably creepy guy, but I'm amazed that in the 90s Chinland was never able to, like, sort of switch that, like, inherent creepiness to becoming like a stock bad guy in films. Like, I'm really, really amazed at that.
Yeah, to me, the most unsettling thing, maybe the fingers in the freezer. It's like, what, does he eat those? Like, it's just...
They're finger food, Zach.
Literally. Oh my god, you had to go there.
I do. I think that's meant to be Dahmer. Like, I think quite clearly the character is Donnie Faster's muddled on several other people. Like, obviously Ted Bundy and Jeffrey Dahmer. Like, Dahmer, when he was arrested, was found with parts of bodies in his fridge, for example. And, like, Bundy was known to approach women in car parks and stuff like that, like he does. And like, there is this sense of, like, there's a sense of, like, this is what evil looks like. It doesn't look like a demon with pointy ears. It looks like this seemingly normal guy who's maybe a little bit socially awkward, but maybe he hides that very, very well. And that's what really scares us. And what we do with things that scare us is we cast them in a way that makes them seem different, that seems to exist beyond us. And I think that's something The X-Files does quite well as a show. Like, you have, like, this idea of the Second World War guilt that becomes the conspiracy and stuff like that. But even stuff like... back in the old days, you know, myths about vampires and werewolves and all this sort of stuff. There's many historians who believe that, like, stories about werewolves are actually stories about serial killers who existed, because people couldn't believe that somebody human could have done these actions, and that their behavior was, like, animalistic, so that they believed that they were literally turned into animals, like, just as a way of differentiating or separating, you know, normal people, so-called normal people, from these horrible actions.
Right, and much in the same way, whenever there's a tragedy or anything of this nature that a human being commits, people are like, oh, he's crazy, he's nuts. And it's like, well, it's easy to write something off like that. Like, no, he's not crazy, he's just evil, you know, because evil's out there in the world. And I don't know if Jeff Johns is an X-Files fan. Jeff Johns is my favorite comic book writer, and he's risen in the ranks over the years. Now he's one of the top guys at DC Comics right now, helping with the films and the television. And Donnie Fester, in this episode, it reminded me of how Jeff Johns reinvented the Green Lantern villain, the Black Hand, who was a creepy funeral home worker obsessed with death. And again, this is what Jeff Johns excels at. He takes all these weird concepts, like from the bygone silver age of comic books, updates them, and makes an interesting new twist on it. So
yeah, and I mean, it is actually, now that you mention it, I can't unsee that, because I mean, yeah, John's work on Green Lantern was amazing. Not to get too far off the point, but yeah, the twisting of concepts. So actually, I much prefer Brian Michael Bendis's version of evil, which is like, and when Bendis writes like Daredevil and Spider-Man, his conception of evil, which is a lot more mundane than say Carter or John's, is basically, what if these people had like incredible ideas, like they could build giant stilts or they could build suits of armor, but all that they could think to do with them was rob banks. That's Brian Bendis's version of evil, is just like mundane boredom. And I think that I like that, but I also like the grandiose sort of John/Carter, what if evil is truly monstrous, what if evil is like this thing that we try and present as something that is beyond mankind. And like, it comes back in stuff like, say, the black oil in the mythology, which is a very literal representation. It's literal blackness that infects and contaminates a person and changes them into doing something truly monstrous, and then literally physically transforms the body as well. Like, I think you can see that in the way that like Irresistible kind of hints at with Donnie, where it's like Donnie is a more mundane form of evil than this, but the basic idea is the same. It's like, what if there is something like transformative? What if there is something horrifying, but it's within you?
All right, Darren, it's been fun talking about these two episodes of The X-Files with you today. If people want to find you online, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter at Darren_Mooney. I host the 250, which is a movie podcast covering the IMDb's top 250 movies of all time. You can find us on Twitter at the 250, spelt using real letters. You can also find us on the Black Hole Media Podbean and on Spotify. Sorry, not on Spotify, on iTunes and wherever good podcasts are available. I also have a book coming out, which I'm very excited about, Opening the X-Files. You mentioned at the start there. Available where all good books are sold. Thanks.
As for me, you can find me on Twitter at MoronZach. That's MoreOnZach. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Sold on Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. We're on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. And I'm also the host of Standard Orbit, a Star Trek The Original Series podcast. You can find us on Twitter at TrekFM. As for the XCast, you can find us on Twitter at @X_cast and our Facebook page and group, the XCast X-Files Podcast Fan Group. So just search the XCast on Facebook and you'll find us there. Well, the Pod Watch will be back tomorrow covering Die Hand, Die Verletz, and Fresh Bones. But until then, trust no one.